There'll be food and drink and ghosts, and perhaps even a few murders. You're all invited.
Welcome to Slumber Party Monsters. I'm your host Faith, as always, and we've got Luna Wolf with us today.
Hi, how you doing?
Lovely, much better. I feel much more awake and recharged now.
Fantastic, I love that.
Yes, I've had two coffees and a nice roast dinner, so I'm happy.
That's one of the things I miss being out here is roast dinners.
Well, when you're back in the UK, we'll do one for you.
Oh, hell yeah, I'm into that.
This is part three of Women Filmmakers. And yeah, so Luna has starred in quite a few horror indie movies. She directs, does stunt work, and I think you've got a bigger resume than I do in terms of like jack of all trades, if I'm honest, so...
I just follow the dopamine, what can I say?
Yeah. Let that just guide your way and let the neurospicy kick
absolutely.
In.
Absolutely. Would it really be living if you didn't?
I don't know. I don't know how neurotypicals work, so...
Right. I don't understand them either. I love them, but I don't understand them.
Yeah, my wife is neurotypical, so there are times where she has to sit down and kind of, right, explain this thought process to me, please.
That must be an adventure in itself.
It can be. There are times where it's kind of like, let me draw a diagram.
Yeah.
But yeah. What films have you got today?
What films have I got? Oh, blimey. In terms of the stuff I'm working on, or?
Stuff you're working on, films that you've done, and what was it? Other... women in the horror and not the film industry as well, like any particular films that you're like, you know what, I like this film and it's directed by a woman.
Okay, well, to start, we've just finished wrapping on Scorpio last year. We did our last day of filming back in September, and that has been wrapped up in the previous months of the last year. Which year are we even in right now? I'm just thinking, like, all right, we're in 2024. I just had to double check this. The last few years have been a bit weird. So yeah, we wrapped in September last year. It got completed November. We had the premiere showing on my birthday, which was the 10th of November. That went down really well. And we have just been winning award after award after award for that movie ever since. So much so that I've just stopped submitting it now because we've got so many awards, we can't fit it on one poster. And that story, that was an interesting story to get that production going, because there's a long history with Scorpio. When Mike, you know Mike, he approached me, oh God, when was it now? It must have been maybe 2021. He approached me and he was like, hey, do you want to be part of my anthology for the first volume of Horoscopes? And it's an anthology based on the 12 zodiacs. And I was like, dude, you had me at do you wanna. And so we went through and we did all of the picking the names out of the hat thing, and we ended up with Scorpio. But the production kind of went sideways from then onwards. So I shot and I filmed the movie with a couple of friends of mine, because I was moving to Canada at the time and I didn't really have much time or access to just things that would help me film this. So my friends agreed to do it. And it was an emotional and a turmoil type of a time of my life right then, because these friends didn't really turn out to be actual friends. And so I had to suddenly reshoot the entire thing. So at the time when I needed to reshoot, I was actually part of the Vancouver Film School, and I just looked around and I was just like, Jesus, I've got so many creative geniuses around me right now. Why don't I ask them to help me reshoot this? Because I need to reshoot very fast. I need to make it the best I can. And I've got like 20 plus people I can ask. And at this point, we only really know each other for like 2 months. And literally everybody said yes. And so we were experiencing a huge commitment from our school, because we were like in school between, most days we were in school between 9 a.m. and 6 to 7 p.m., maybe even 8 p.m. most days. But we were going into term two shoots at the time. Now, the term two shoots are designed to get everybody on set to have an experience at doing everything in terms of the role structures of being on set and in a crew. So I, at the time, was being involved with 19 short movies for the school. I don't know how we managed to do this, to be honest, because we were writing the scripts, we were planning the shoots, we were planning the shots, we were, as a DOP, we were planning where our lighting was going, and we were measuring the light sources and calculating like the ratio between the shadows and the light. And then we were going off and we were doing like production and doing all the props for somebody else's movie. And then we were in a first AD position, and we were breaking down the scripts, and we were doing everything that a first AD would do. But we were doing this in a really short amount of time. I think we only had about 4 weeks to prepare for these 19 shoots. And so on top of this, I was trying to organize Scorpio for the reshoot, because I knew how important it was to MJ to be able to have a piece, a segment that was worth showing to people, that I had all of the paperwork in check for, because obviously he wants to then put it on Blu-ray and distribute. So there was an awful lot that I was having to do at the time. And I just remember looking back. So the last December when we graduated, I looked back and I was like, geez, we really pulled it out of the bag in terms of Scorpio this year, because once we had started the ball rolling on those term two shoots, we had 19 days solid where we didn't have a day off, and we were on set from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. some days. And on top of that, then I was... I was planning on flying back to the UK to shoot Slasher House 3. So we came straight out of the term two shoots, and it was like long days. And I went straight onto the airport, straight into, I think it was a 13 or a 14 hour flight. From that flight, I ended up at the car hire place. I got the car hire. I drove 3 hours to my brother's place, and he was like, you cannot drive right now, you're tired. So we then drove another hour and a half, 2 hours from my brother's place where I was staying at the time, straight onto set. So it was airport, my brother's, set, all in the same day. And then we did a couple of hours shooting on Slatter House, and then we ended up being able to go home for a bit of a rest. But then every single day of that spring break, like, I was on set with the with MJ, and it was like, I just remember it being a bit of a blur because of the tiredness, but I like being on set with the Myco crew and everything again, and being part of Slash House just kept me going, if that makes any sense. I was tired, but at the same time I was buzzing to be back on set in the UK with all of my buddies again. And I just remember the last day of shoot, we were on set, and then I was like, right, cool, now I've got to go back to the airport straight from here. And I did. I drove to the airport, I dropped off the car, I checked in, and I got on the airplane, and boom, I was back over here in Vancouver, and I didn't stop. My feet did not hit the ground. And I came back, I went straight back into classes. And I remember the following weekend, I was like, oh, I've got some time off. Finally, you know. But instead of resting and slowing down, it turned out that one of my friends, one of my female dirt biker friends, she was like, hey, do you want to come up to this track and come camping with a bunch of us girlies, and I've got a dirt bike that you can borrow and everything like that. So I was like, cool, you know what, I need a little bit more excitement. I don't know what became of me, but I remember we did an off-road track, and then we came back, and then we were doing some tricks and everything, and I remember just going around this corner and hitting this jump. And I remember, as like, I hit the jump and I got some air, and I was like, cool, I hit that jump a little bit crooked. And then I was like, oh, I'm flying. Oh, wait. Oh, no, I'm not going to land this. And then I ended up landing funny. And my hand was still on the handlebars, but I remember punching myself in the neck on the way down. And I broke my collarbone, and I dislocated my shoulder in two places. And this was on the first day of the weekend. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm okay. That didn't hurt so much. And then I stood up, and just the sheer pain is like searing through my body. So the next, I don't know, 6-8 months, I had my arm in a sling. And like, my pal took me to hospital that day. They took some x-rays. They were like, yeah, you've cracked your collarbone. It wasn't a clean break, thankfully. Otherwise, I probably would have had to maybe be in a cast or something. I don't really know how they fix things. But I remember the next week I came in to school, and everybody's like, are you okay? What's going on? And I was like, I broke my collarbone. And they were like, are you going to be okay to film Scorpio? Because like, that's coming up very, very quickly. Like, this was the following weekend. And so me and my crew, we just scrambled to get everything together and everything organized. And my stunt coordinator, Ashley Earl, she's one of the most amazing people on the planet. Like, she was like, hey, so I've got this really cool holistic thing to heal bodies really quickly. And like, she took me through all of this way to heal after broken bones and things, and she really taught me the stunt actor's way of recovering. And I don't think I would have been able to pull Scorpio off if it hadn't have been for her, because she was able, she managed to get it so that I was able to function without a sling just as we were going into filming Scorpio. And my crew just like really like pulled everything out of the bag. They all got together and they were like, yes, we're going to make this work. Here's the lighting plan. Here's the scheduling plan. Here's the transport plan. Here's, you know, here's A, B, and C. And like, to have a crew that I stole from my class, essentially, to turn around and just be so professional and so creative with their support and like their work, and be so dedicated. And like, many of these people were like 19, 20 years old. And I remember like, there was a moment in the filming of it, and I remember looking at everybody and just saying, wow, geez, these guys are incredible. These humans are doing this out of the kindness of their heart. Like, yeah, I paid them, but at the same time, they've gone above and beyond as to what I asked them for. And it was one of the most magical moments of my life in terms of like work and film and friendship and everything. So that was the story as to how Scorpio got made. And like, I know that, yeah, I could have spent more time with the actors and like really developed the characters and everything. But at the same time, I wrote that script in 2 hours in between classes, you know? And the fact that we've won so many awards on this movie, and it's really putting things into perspective as to what we are capable of under so much pressure. And moving forwards into Siren, it's already suddenly become a much bigger production than I originally intended because of the amount of help that is being directed our way to make this movie. Sorry, I'm just like talking.
No. I'm literally just sitting there like really enjoying this. It's like, oh wow.
Yeah, this is one of the most profound stories I've had so far in terms of making short movies. Like Scorpio has really changed my perspective on how I make movies and the people who I make movies with, because I know that I had a perfect crew on that movie. There was nothing I would have changed when it came to that movie. Like the actresses were so on it because they were both stunt actresses as well. So they were both trained in fighting, both trained in like stairfalls. Like Ella really wanted to do a stairfall in the story. And so I wrote a stairfall in for her so that she could have that. And Holly is just like, she's so dedicated to her work. She's so like, I mean, I sent you the link of the movie, and there is a moment in there where she goes, "Let me tell you a little bit about me and my friends." And that whole speech that she doesn't blink once. And her delivery of the character was so on point. Like, I don't know how she managed to get that out of my head without me being able to be there for her in terms of frequent meetings, like, because we were all like in this whirlwind tornado of like, we just have to get this movie done now because there are so many other things that we have to do. Because as soon as Scorpio was being filmed, like, I was also then directing a Term 3 shoot, of which like I pitched for it, I won the pitch for it, and then I went, oh no, I'm I'm now burning the candle at every direction, and I'm not even sure if I'm going to be able to give anybody my attention enough to be able to make something good out of it. But because of the people that I have around me, that it all just kind of magically came together like a puzzle piece, and I'm just so grateful that it happened the way it did. And off the back of that, now we're, like I say, we're doing Siren now, which is the third iteration of the horoscopes. And I'm taken back because we've only got 1 month until we shoot, and already we've organized the actors. We've already got the actors in tow. I need to do some meetings with them just to make sure that they're comfortable with everything that I'm looking for in terms of their role. The only person I need to cast for is Micah's girlfriend. There's that. Actually, I haven't told anybody about what the movie is about. So maybe I should start there.
Yeah, because I'm curious about that as well.
Hiya, is this where I am?
Yeah.
All right. Hi, I'm Luna Wolf, and wait, I didn't think about that. I'm Luna Wolf, and I'm the director and producer of Siren. Let me introduce you to some of my team.
I'm Anthony. I am writing and I'm head of sound.
My name is Luke Vassi. I'm the cinematographer for Siren.
Hi, my name is Connor Nyan and I am the gaffer for Siren.
Oh, well, my name is Danita and I am going to be doing sound.
I'm Minette. I am the costume designer for Siren.
So, Siren, yeah. MJ asked me to be a part of Siren, and obviously I said yes. And I know I said no to Volume 2 because I was filming Scorpio again. But so Siren is a Babylonian creature. We're basing it on, we're making a hybrid. We're making a hybrid. So in history, the Siren is either a mermaid or it is more of a bird-like creature. Some people might associate a siren with more of a harpy type character, but many, many people, they imagine a fish tail and singing and luring men to their deaths. And that's pretty much where the history ends, because there's not a lot in terms of Babylonian specific sirens. There's like others in different cultures, but Babylonian is kind of like there's a loose history behind it. And I kind of wanted to play on that a little bit to, because this is fantasy, right? Like, this is our story. We get to do whatever we want with it. So, and I was wondering whether or not we should just sort of make our own hybrid, which is where we're going down. So we're designing the siren to be kind of half mermaid, half harpy, half like bird-like creature, but we're not going to lean into the tail, simply for the fact that the cost of production would have been so much more, and the mobility of our creature would have been next to nothing unless we shot in water. And the legalities of shooting in water is like, you have to have a huge budget for that type of thing. You know, you have to have some coordinator, then you have to have a dive team, and, you know, you have to have an actress who is happy to spend a lot of time underwater and things like that. So, like, I immediately just sort of went, okay, let's not do this, because this is something that I would like to maybe put into a feature if we ever got the budget for that. So we designed it to be half bird, but also play upon the fish-like elements of it. So like, the song of the siren and the sound of water and everything is something that I'm going to be playing into that. But the story starts with our protagonist, Mika or Mika, depending on where you come from, is depending on how you would pronounce it. She is a lesbian photographer for like an auction room type thing, but it's for antiquities. And she's there with her boss at the studio, and her boss is like unpacking stuff and, you know, going through some props and bits and pieces and sort of talking about the show that they're going to be putting on. And she snatches a puzzle box out of his hands because he's like unable to open it. And she's very neurodivergent in terms of like the way that she acts and reacts to things. So she's like, oh, I know I can figure this out, but it's not like prominent. I didn't want anything to be forced. So she snatches this box out of his hands, and she figures out the code to it, because it's an ancient Babylonian box. And when she breaks open the box, this amulet comes out and falls on the floor, and it cracks, and it's seeping like this oily substance that she thinks is like, oh, whatever, we'll figure this out later type thing. And she's got to go off, and she's got to go and see her girlfriend at a music venue, motorcycle music venue. So she goes off on a bike, and basically she goes to see her girlfriend, spend some time with her girlfriend and their pals, and she looks at the motorbikes and things like that. And meanwhile, her boss, Thomas, is having not the time of his life. In fact, this amulet has released something that he really didn't want to experience. And the story, I don't want to give too much away, but the story is just basically from then on, it's Micah just trying to figure out what's going on and what this creature is, and what happens to Thomas is pretty insane. We've got some very interesting but horrific prosthetics that I want to be making in the next couple of weeks. Let's just say there's going to be blood. There's going to be blood. There's going to be lots of it. And I can't wait for everybody to watch this movie, because it touches upon Babylonian mystery. It touches upon it touches upon loyalty within relationships. It touches upon friendships. It touches upon family as well. It's got elements of stunts in terms of motorcycles. I'm going to be doubling for Micah on a big Harley Davidson Fat Boy that I've recently had blacked out as well. So it's going to look incredible. And we've got the Harley Davidson. What is the word? I'm looking for a word here.
Model?
Model, not the model. It's like a community. So,
gang, a biker gang.
Yeah, but not a biker gang. I think it is more of a community than a biker gang. But the biggest Harley Davidson showroom in Vancouver has agreed to allow us to use their back lot. Sorry, my little brain is so tired. And we're gonna put together a party scene, and we're gonna put out a casting call for anybody who's in Vancouver who owns a motorcycle, who wants to be in a horror movie. And we're gonna get everybody down, and we're gonna show off their bikes, and we're gonna have a nice time. we've already organized the permits and everything so that we can go later than 10 p.m., which is a big thing here in Vancouver. You have to tell the certain areas what you're doing, why you're doing it, what you're planning on doing. So we've also had help from the people who issue the permits as well to be able to shoot this scene. I'm really excited about it too. So, you know, being surrounded by loads of people with their motorcycles is one of the things that I love doing in general. And especially if I'm able to mesh that with my bike and also my movie making, then it's a dream come true, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just all of your interests, skill sets, and things been working towards for years are just all molded together.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all becoming, it's all coming to fruition. And one of my good friends, Todd, he owns Masters FX. So on the 13th of April, we're planning on having a fundraiser here in Vancouver for the extra little pieces that we need for our movie. I've managed to secure so much, but at the same time, I also want to be able to feed my crew. So the extra money that is going to be raised by our Indiegogo campaign, we have one of those set up already, and also the fundraiser. I'm hoping to be able to feed my crew some healthy food to keep them going, because, you know, an empty stomach, you can't concentrate, right? So that's the least I can try and do for my amazing crew, who I don't think I would be here without them, you know?
It definitely shows from the Scorpio that everyone cared about what they were making, and they cared about you, they cared about what the end result, and it just, yeah, because you sent me the link to watch it and I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And it was can tell that everyone's they worked well together, they did come across as being, how to put it, it's
we're a film family.
Exactly, yeah.
We're not just doing this to get paid. I mean, it would be nice to get paid because, you know, we can't pay our bills on hugs. But at the same time, it's like we as a collective, we have this passion in our blood that we cannot stop making movies and we cannot stop making film. It's like Connor, who was my DOP for Scorpio, he won Best Cinematography Award for his part in Scorpio. And it's like Malik, he won Best Editor Award for Scorpio. And like Charlie, he won Best Composer, Best Original Soundtrack. You know, it's not just me winning like Best Producer, Best Director, Best Story or anything like that. It's more the fact that I am able to carry my crew along with me on this journey. And like I have switched around the roles a little bit for Siren. So now Luke Vassy, he is my DOP because I know that he's got it in the bag, but I also want to give him the space to be able to create something that he's going to be proud of, if that makes any sense. And like Connor is like, he is a lens and camera genius. If you ask him to do something, he will figure out a way of making it happen, especially on a budget for like, you know, camera things. Because like I in Siren, I wanted to replicate the effect for Blade Runner. So, you know, that shine in their eyes in the original Blade Runner that makes their eyes shine as replicants. I was like, Connor, how do you think we can make this happen? Because like I heard that we can do this on set rather than in post. And he comes back to me and he goes, I figured it out. He was like, I figured this out. So we've got a whole video on how we recreated that effect in camera on our Indiegogo campaign. There's a video that explains how we did it. But I just like, I'm so taken back at how incredibly talented everybody on set is. Like we've got Sheree, one of my good friends. Her website is Princess Shredder. I think it's .com. I'll have to find the exact details. But she is a film format photographer whose art is absolutely insane. She is so, so talented, and she's got her own like fundraising and that going on. And I just love celebrating everybody who is around me at the moment, and you know, making sure that everybody gets seen for how incredibly talented they are, you know?
I'm sure they all appreciate the fact that you gave them that opportunity to show off their skills and their...
Yeah.
That, what they're capable of, that the fact that it's not just you gaining these awards, it's, you know, composers, camber people, there's... like the audio and stunt work, like all of that, and everyone's being recognised for it. And it's not something you hear about very often. So the fact they're actually getting awards for that is, it shows that you work well with them, and the fact that they know what they're doing as well.
Oh yeah, most of them I know from the Vancouver Film School. So we all graduated back in December. But like me, most of them were already talented before they went to school. And just for me, being able to give them, shine a spotlight, even though they they don't necessarily like the spotlight being shone upon them very much, but like being able to be recognized for the hard and dedicated work that they have been putting in, it just gives me pure joy when I turn around and I go, hey, Malik, you ended up with a... You just got an award for your editing, and just seeing his little face light up and he's like so incredibly proud of his work. Oh my God, I'm welling up. I'm going to cry. It just gives me pure joy, you know, like I'm not just doing this for me. This is not about me even. This is about writing stories and being able to show other people's work as well as my own. But even so, at the same time, being able to carry the LGBTQ community along with it as well, because I'm gay, and like many of my friends are, and I know that we as a community have not been, and when I say community, I'm talking gay, gay, trans, bi, you know, lesbians, anybody who are on that spectrum, we haven't really been recognized and supported very much in terms of story, in especially horror movies. Like, if you get like a gay couple, something would happen to them and one of them would die tragically. And I'm just like, well, I'm over this 13th chapter, you know? I don't know if you ever heard of the 13th chapter.
No, but I know that the trope that you're on about the
like
the lesbian must die in order for the story to progress.
Right?
Like, for God's sake, again?
Exactly. So like back in the day when books were around and people would actually read them, there was this thing going around where there would be gay stories being put in books so that people could read it, but the 13th chapter would always be something tragically would happen to them and they wouldn't be allowed a happy ending. I want to smash that 13th chapter. I want to get rid of that, and I want to give us as a community that happy ending, that romance, but in a horror movie standpoint, where, you know, like we don't end up having a tragic ending, but at the same time, I don't want to stomp on everybody else, if that makes any sense. So being a lesbian, yes, I love women, but so many people are like, oh, you must be a man hater and stuff. I'm like, no, you don't get it. I've got four brothers, if you count my step, and I absolutely love all of them. And so why would I want to bash men? Men are amazing. Just, I love them. I just don't love them, if that makes any sense. So, yeah. So I'm trying to create stories where everybody gets their say and everybody gets to be seen in a different light. And again, like I say, I want to delete that 13th chapter out of our history.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to do an episode on queer horror movies with you, because there's been quite a few in like recent years that have been popping out more often. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah, I think I would be very, very excited to do that with you. There are so many stories that I'm just like, oh, yeah, here we go. This is a character I can relate to. And then, boom, something happens. I was like, goodness. Okay, here we go again.
Yeah. Oh, it's just like, oh God, some of the tropes that come up and
yeah, it's not something that I would be into. And do you know what? Like, if I'm thinking this, then like, who else is thinking this? You know, I got to a point where I stopped watching horror movies because of the fact that there was nothing that I could relate to in it. Like, either they were in their late teens or early 20s, and I mean, I'm now pushing 40. I just couldn't relate to it because everybody was just far too young for the story for me. And I'm just like, well, this is more directed at somebody who's maybe 20 years younger than me, and I get it, and I'm appreciative of that, and it's a beautiful piece of art. But where are those movies that I can then relate to? Where are those movies that I want to watch? You know, and I'm just still looking, and I'm decided that maybe I should be making the movies that I want to watch, you know?
Why not? I mean, you have the experience, you understand how, in terms of storytelling and actually understanding the feelings between two women.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And like, I know that women can be hella toxic.
Oh fuck yeah, yeah.
Believe me, I've been through a lot of it to know that actually, you know what, I'm good. I'm just gonna make movies that have romance in there, and I'm not gonna put myself out there anymore and look for it. If somebody comes along that is able to put up with my crazy filmmaking, then yeah, great. But I've currently gotten to the age where I'm tired, you know.
I mean, pushing 40, I would not have put you at that kind of age range, if I'm honest.
Well, thank you. Many people say that too. They're all like, oh, I thought you were 25. I'm like, no. I'm a little older than I make out. I may act like a absolute child sometimes, and I may get overexcited about things. But yeah, this is not my first rodeo, and I am looking forward to after Siren. I'm looking forward to finally being able to bring some horror, gay friendly feature films into fruition through my new connections in my new life here in Vancouver.
I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing those, if I'm honest with you. I mean,
I can't wait. I can't wait to tell you all about it. It's gonna be great. I've got like four feature films that I'm currently preparing for. Hopefully one of the first ones will come through soon. The first one, I have to give like a trigger warning. It is going to have a bad and toxic lesbian relationship in it. But this story is very much based around some of the very real experiences that I've experienced in my life. And that's all I can say, apart from the fact that it is a creature film, it is a horror film, and it is a feature, and I've got so much in the works for it. I'm so excited.
I've met you had me a creature feature and lesbian and like gay people. I'm like, yes, I'm here for it.
Yep. Gay people are gonna have their say. Like I say, the main character doesn't have the best experience in her love life, but at the same time, there are a lot of characters in the movie that will be having very, very happy gay experience. It's going to be, Mimic meets Party Monster, which is hella insane. And everybody's like, how the hell are you going to pull this off? And I'm just like, trust me, I know enough about this industry that I'm writing about to be able to then deliver it onto screen, which again is like, I've worked with some people in the past who haven't really understood certain aspects of the story. So like, am I allowed to say that I was going, I used to organize fetish parties.
Yeah, that's fun to mention.
Yeah, so I in the UK, I used to help organise fetish parties, and I used to spend a lot of time in the BDSM community. And what can I say? I'm a veteran of 12 years of experience in that. So being able to write kinky gay love stories with kinky aspects of it and kinky clothing, but it's not like, I don't know, it's not a full-on porno. I'm not going in that direction with this movie, but at the same time, it's going to be very kind of Hellraiser-esque. And okay. Yeah, it's going to be Hellraiser-esque. It's going to be very climax. It's going to be very Party Monster. It's going to be very Mimic as well. That's the only way that I can actually really explain where I'm going from, because it is such a unique story. I'm aiming for a 90-minute movie with that, and I'm hoping to get a couple of really big names involved in that. And I've already said too much. You can definitely air this. It's fine. But like, yeah, there's a lot there that I'm still working on and figuring out in terms of the logistics of everything. So, but I'm hoping that maybe I can start filming it in the fall.
I mean, that sounds absolutely fantastic. I'm looking forward to like seeing updates about it and everything.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to being able to give people updates about it too. So yeah, the creature design is, I've never seen anything like it before. If I'm honest, I started designing it 7 years ago, and I started developing the story 7 years ago based on some of my own personal experiences. And the creatures are very fantasy based. They're not. I never encountered one of these creatures, let's put it that way. But my brain went in that direction when I was thinking about it, and I was like, "Oh, this is something that I don't think anybody's actually really tapped into. I mean, potentially The Void would be something that I would say is an influence on me, even though I didn't really watch the rest of it. Like, I watched the beginning of it when he was supposed to be, like, dying. But, yeah. There you go. There's a bunch of clues there for you to ponder upon. Nobody else has ever been told this, so you're the first.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, apart from the people who are helping me develop it, obviously.
But yeah, yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, one of the reasons why I'm doing the women filmmakers as like a special thing for this month, mm-hmm. partly to do with International Women's Day, but also because there's a charity in the UK called Wellbeing of Women.
Okay.
And it's the only UK-based charity that actually does education and research on the gynecological health.
Okay, and it's a very, very important subject because so many women have been, for lack of a better term, gaslit by the medical industry in terms of that.
Most definitely, and it's either sort of like pushed aside or saying or being thrown from one doctor to another specialist to another situation. Yep.
And hearing that there is nothing wrong with you when clearly there is something going on is not what anybody wants to hear, especially a woman.
Exactly. So I am doing a fundraiser this month for that charity on the Just Giving page. And the I've asked my two previous guests this question. Neither of them have got it right.
Okay. Oh, my God. The pressure.
Okay. So my question is, what is the average diagnosis time in the UK for someone with endometriosis?
The average, I should know this. Funnily enough, I should know this. I know very many people who've suffered immensely with this, and I actually don't know the exact number, but I believe it to be more than a year.
Yep. Average, and quite a few articles have said that the UK average is 7.5 years from onset symptoms.
7.5 years.
Yep.
Hang on. I'm just trying to get this around my head. 7.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Let me just pull up the symptoms of this.
It's not nice.
Like, because I know some of the symptoms, but I just obviously because I'm ADHD, I need to be reminded and a list. But some of the symptoms of endometriosis, if people don't really understand it, is, you know, this is going to be. All right. Anybody who's eating right now really needs to stop just for a second, right?
Okay.
Some of the symptoms of endometriosis is diarrhea or constipation during menstrual period or during the month as well, right? Normally you would be, you would, you know, be like, oh, well, you know, I've just eaten something dodgy and it will clear up. But this is an everyday type thing. It's either one or the other, right? You get low fatigue or low energy, high fatigue or low energy. And that's like, it's almost like being hungover for the entirety of your life, you know, feeling so tired, run down and drained. You get heavy or irregular periods. Now, the heavy periods, you lose so much blood that you just get like dizzy and again, lethargic and tired, right? But it doesn't stop there. You get pain, you get like all sorts of other problems, like, I don't know, it's just for those who are hetero-inclined, they would get pain after being intimate with their partner. But you get, like, chronic pain, you get mood swings, you get bloating, you get a lot of, like, hormonal problems as well. And, you, like, some people who I know with endometriosis have told me and basically said to me that they feel crazy for weeks of the month, like weeks, not just days, weeks. And you know, it affects anxiety, depression. And imagine having to then go out into the world and pretend everything is okay because you then have to work a full-time job, you know? Imagine working a full-time job when you're bleeding heavily and unable to stand up even, and the pain is so excruciating that you're throwing up as well, and you're having to do a 9-to-5 and just concentrate on what's going on around you. Yeah, endometriosis is a horrific thing to have, and I'm absolutely applauding you to be like going down this road and being able to do a fundraiser for people who really suffer.
Yeah, I mean, they do, this charity helps with quite a few things, preparing to talk to a doctor about things.
Yeah.
They even have an article, which is, I thought was absolutely shocking, that says that if you feel that you haven't been treated correctly by a medical professional, and that the fact that they even have that section on the website is shocking.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's funny because my experience of the NHS in the UK, like I've had all sorts of medical problems and I've been seen by all sorts of doctors and they've done all sorts of tests on me only to turn around and say, hey, we think it's all in your head. And I'm like, well, that's cool. But if it is all in my head, then how are we going to then move forward to be able to correct this? Because I cannot live like this. The amount of times I've been gaslit by men or women even in my life and basically said, oh, there's nothing wrong with you. You know, you're just complaining. You're just putting this on. And can you imagine how that feels? Like, I mean, obviously you can, but like I'm talking about the people who don't like necessarily experience that kind of thing on a daily basis. It's like turning around and saying that somebody has blue hair when they really don't. And telling them over and over and over again to the point that actually they're crazy. They do have blue hair and they're looking at themselves in the mirror and they're like, well, no, I've got black hair. Like, am I the problem? Am I really that crazy? And then you start believing that you're crazy.
I've known people that have had issues with treatment in order for people to actually be either diagnosed for something or they're thrown from like one doctor to another.
Yeah.
Go and have scans done, having MRIs done, and then being told, like, we can't find anything.
Yeah.
And it's like, are you kidding me? Like, this has been going on for ages, and I've got a different opinion from a different doctor and specialist each time I go and see someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, endometriosis is cysts and things growing or where they shouldn't be, and you know, like to have scans come up and say that there's nothing there, you know, it's kind of debilitating, not just mentally but physically as well, because you end up pushing yourself the extra mile because you've been told that there's nothing wrong with you, you shouldn't be feeling like this, you know, so you try and push through it and you end up exhausting yourself like 10 times more than you already would have done if you had rested, you know. Like I'm a huge believer on the idea that if the body says no, then you should really, really listen. But the way that the society is nowadays, you have to push through it. Otherwise you're labeled as crazy, even though there is something horrendously wrong in the sense that it's, you know, classed as a chronic disease. I just, I think in terms of this particular thing, I think that education really should be one of the main factors in terms of the health industry to start with, because like when I went to the doctor here about my ADHD, she really, really listened to me and she was like, oh, okay, well, like I can see that you're doing this sitting in front of me, and she was actually taking me seriously. And it was something that I wasn't used to, and I don't want to slam the NHS too hard, because let's face it, you know, they looked after me when they thought that I had chemical pneumonia from burning my lungs out fire breathing. You know, like there are certain areas of the NHS that are actually very, very good, But at the same time, in terms of things, especially the women's health, I think there definitely needs to be some kind of change in the industry to be able to support women who have endometriosis. Because what is the ratio? I think it's 1 in 4 women have it or something.
Yeah, it's very high, which is shocking given that it's just like my thought process is that the, you know how some people, like if a woman goes into a doctor's office and they say, like the videos we see of women that have like just given birth.
Yeah.
They've got like a child to look after. They've got all these things to deal with and all these other problems.
Yep.
And then you've got like your, I'm going to say it's a heterosexual thing, that you've got your male partner but they go to a doctor and they get seen and they are listened to.
Yeah.
Like if a woman goes to see a doctor and you say, I think I've got these concerns, how many times have you been told by a doctor, oh, don't worry about it, dear?
Yeah.
And you think, I bet you've never said that to a bloke.
Absolutely. Like, for instance, when I was 15 years old, I ended up falling down the stairs, catching my toes in the banister slats on the way down.
Oh, sorry, just a thought.
Yeah, it's okay. I shattered the knuckle in my foot and I broke 2 of my toes, right? I put my shoe on, I went to school because, you know, that's kind of what I used to do back then. And 5 years later, I'm like, I am still not able to walk correctly on this foot. And I took myself to the doctor and the doctor was like, oh, well, yeah, you know, I mean, it does sort of seem a bit weird considering it looks like that you've had stunted growth in your toes on this one foot. And I'm like, all right, well, clearly I had an accident and this is the story. And he was like, well, yeah, you know, I think you should put a pad under it, bandage it up and then, you know, see how you get on and that should be all right from there. Anyway, a couple of years later, I am literally like, I can't walk properly on my foot. I'm going to go for a second opinion. And I actually really forced for this second opinion. And they sent me for an x-ray and it turns out that I shattered my foot. I shattered that knuckle and the toe to the point where there was like shards of bone floating around in my joint. And that was part of the reason why I was in so much pain. But then they took me to hospital and they were like, right, we're going to remove these pieces of bone because they could migrate and cause you problems, you know? And I'm just like, wow, you know, five years of me just walking around and just getting on with it, trying to walk it off. And it was actually something very serious. And just taking that one experience and plastering it on the rest of my experiences, like I've had gut health issues, I've had all sorts of things go on. But I've had the same exact experience with very many of my doctors. They're like, walk it off type thing. So I'm literally standing here and I'm going, well, I might have concussion because of a training thing that I did at a stair fall. So I did a couple of stair falls in 2019 and I ended up with head injuries, 2 of them. But my current doctor is like, yeah, you ended up with concussion. I'm going to send you for a brain scan to make sure that you're okay. Because the throbbing in your head and the really loud tinnitus, that's not normal. You shouldn't be having to walk around with that every single day of your life. And yet, when I actually had that accident back in 2019, I just walked off, you know? And I feel like so many women in this world, especially in the medical industry, have been ignored, gaslit, and sent on their way when something like a chronic disease like endometriosis is in existence and so many women suffer from it. Like what kind of a world do we live in?
It does make me think about how if someone was to, the fact that people can literally figure out if like, for example, if a plane was having a mechanical fault, you could troubleshoot what the issue is, where it started, what caused it.
Yep.
and they can, like, figure out all that out in a fucking plane.
Yep.
But you can't figure out if someone's like excessively bleeding to the point where they are becoming anemic, essentially.
Right, and imagine that. Imagine losing so much blood that you're becoming anemic and you're unable to concentrate. You get foggy brain, you've got lethargic symptoms, you know, you're a little bit irritable because you can't function properly. Your body is basically shutting down because of loss of blood. And yet so many people get ignored. And there's a study actually coming out. It's a very, very new study. It's just word of the wind, so to speak, that I've been looking into. And apparently endometriosis is linked to a certain bacteria in your body that could potentially be cured with a particular antibiotic. But the research isn't there yet. And we're talking antibiotic research.
So that could literally...
It could be as simple as that. It could be as simple as that. That one in maybe four people who are suffering from endometriosis right now. And believe me, like, I know people who have had multiple operations because of endometriosis. I know people who can barely walk because of endometriosis. And the fact that it's just a case of antibiotic research that could potentially cure it completely. Like, come on, world, what are we doing?
It's just, it is quite shocking when you, I mean, I didn't know about that. And to me, that's kind of like a, wait, what? bit of a thing, really.
it's word on the wind. Like, it is just like speculation at the moment. But I've watched a number of TikToks from a number of different creators that they are now suggesting that the cure to endometriosis is a particular antibiotic that they just haven't done enough research in, so they can't do human trials yet.
I mean, to me, something like that, there was a study a little while ago they were trying to develop a contraceptive pill for men. And because the one for women, it's quite... it's a lot of drawbacks, unfortunately, like blood clots, irritability.
Potential cancer, you know, there are so many things.
Yes, unfortunately, that list goes on and on and on. And they stopped doing the trials on men because...
Oh, what? Because of the pill? Because they got irritable?
Oh, no, they stopped it because the guys were getting headaches.
Aww.
I know, little poppets, aren't they?
Oh, little dandelions. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't wish a headache on any guy. I don't wish a headache on literally anyone, because, like I say, I love my brothers. But at the same time, like, the stuff that women have had to go through in the history of human history has been so horrific. Like, I read a report once, there was a gentleman's handbook that suggested that women didn't even have souls. And this was published, like, back in the 70s.
I'm not surprised by that, sadly.
Women don't have souls. They're only there to cook and clean.
Yes, and, yeah, give birth to little crotch goblins for the next generation.
Oh, crotch goblins, I love that. Oh, my God. The reason number 1,000 something, 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 why I would not have kids is I just, what? Why? Yeah, just no. I'm good. I love kids, but I love giving them back at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen I've seen videos of, like, the epidural needle. I'm like, that goes into people's spines.
Well, not only that, though, the reason why a chainsaw was invented, like, what kind of a man invented that? Like, no woman on this planet, either living nor dead, would have ever invented the chainsaw for the reason that it was invented for.
Yeah. I mean, apparently, back in the olden days, a lot of the women that gave birth could have survived a lot longer. They didn't die from the actual given birth. It was the bacteria that they were given by their doctor, because the doctors didn't see the point of washing their hands between patients.
Jeez. And it's just like... Yeah. And so, did you know that laying on your back whilst giving birth is actually not the most easiest nor pain-free method of giving birth. We were meant to give birth standing up.
Squatting. Yeah.
Yeah. But there was a certain king or prince, I remember. I can't remember who he was, but he suggested that his wife or something gave birth like laying down because he had a better view.
What a cunt.
I have got so much in my useless bank of information right now. But you know, it's we've got to be really careful here because like I know we're like, this man did this, this man did this, this man did this, this guy created a chainsaw. You know, like we've got to be really careful though, because this it is literally not all men. It is not. And like I have so many men in my life who are fucking angels and they have the exact same opinion that I have about certain guys who in history who have really messed it up for us all, you know? And this is the reason why we can't have nice things. It's the reason why so many guys are instantly seen as predators when actually they don't mean to be because they haven't been educated enough by the women to know what is right and what is wrong. It's the whole thing with boundaries. Like if you don't state your boundary and help somebody comprehend what it means, how are you supposed to then turn around and say, oh well, you know, you've crossed my boundary, so I'm going to punish you for that. But if somebody didn't know about that boundary in the first place or understand it or understand why, then how are they supposed to learn, right? So there's this whole like thing going on with the world right now, and I'm a little tired about trying to explain it. So I'm just kind of, for me, I'm thinking maybe we should just take all the warning signs off of things and just let people sort of survival of the fittest. But again, that's a controversial opinion. But I genuinely believe that people like us, we have the power to be able to teach people, and it's up to the people as to whether or not they're going to listen to us. And that, I think, dictates the type of people who are going to be moving forwards with this world. Because, like I say, I'm almost 40. I've got so many controversial opinions that I could get cancelled for. But at the same time, I'm just like, if everybody just kind of worked together in a sense of being able to understand each other, then, you know, like, how much of a better world can it be? Because like, okay, now we're going into very controversial subjects like pronouns. Pronouns. I still don't fully understand it, but that's not to say that I'm not willing to learn. Now, I've had a couple of people in my lifetime I've referred to as she or him, and they have turned around and they have come down on my head like a sack of shit. And I'm just like, whoa, okay, can you just like back up a second? Like, what happened here? Where does this come from? How am I supposed to, one, know what your pronouns are if you don't, like, kind of, if we don't have that conversation to start with? How are you supposed to, you know, deliver that information to the general public in terms of things? And I know that some people have like their little badges, and I love them. But at the same time, again, that's something that somebody shouldn't need, if that makes any sense. You shouldn't need to label yourself with an actual badge saying that your pronouns are they or them. And I feel like communication between human beings needs to evolve in a way that everybody can get on the same page, so that the people with different pronouns are seen and heard and understood, but also the people who it's new to are not instantly attacked and feel like they can't ask questions anymore. You know, like, where is that middle ground?
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from with a lot of that. I mean, badges I can kind of understand, because sometimes people might not feel comfortable saying it out loud right away. Like, they're new to it as well.
Yeah. And I think as long as they're comfortable with it, then I think that's a fantastic way of starting out. But what about the people who don't necessarily want to make it a public thing, like walking down the street, etc.? Like, I wouldn't necessarily be walking down the street with a 12-foot lesbian flag, because sometimes my private life is my private life, and only certain individuals would then be able to know about that, if that makes any sense. So, like, there's a huge spectrum in terms of communication that maybe some of us can help other people with, perhaps. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we start a podcast about it. I don't know. But yeah, I feel like there is a lot of animosity going on between human beings, especially the older generation, like millennials and boomers. It's not really the older generation, is it? Are we not? Oh my God.
Not quite there.
But I know that the Gen Zs are like, you know, they have a whole new way of communicating with each other. And I'm wondering whether or not the last 5 years has been a huge attributed to that attribution. Maybe, I don't know what that word is. But I feel like, you know, there's been a very clear split in the way that the younger generations communicate with the older generations because of the last few years and what's been happening in it. I'm just worried, you know, I'm just worried about the human race and the way that we're going.
Yeah, I think it's just, I mean, with, there was actually a little, reminds me, there was a conversation I had with someone at work recently, because they didn't know I was gay.
Mm.
And it's like kind of like a way to, well, kind of like, there was this, there's like a secure room we worked in together.
Yeah.
And we didn't really know each other that well. And it's kind of like, well, what else are we going to do? Just do our jobs while we can talk to each other.
Yeah.
So I asked her about her husband, her kids, and like her, and things like that. And she asked me, like, why do you refer to your husband as your partner? And I said, because not everyone is very, I don't want to get into an argument with someone by saying my wife. If I feel comfortable telling someone that, I will say to them my wife. But if I'm not too sure about them, or I haven't quite sussed you out yet, so I'm gonna say partner for now.
Yeah, and it's also not just that though, like there are a number of questions that can be asked that make you feel uncomfortable. It's like, oh, you know, dearie, like you'll grow out of it, and I'm like, no, I won't. Or like a guy who's like turned around and said, oh, you just haven't met the right man. And I'm like, I tried very hard to conform and fit in your box. Believe me, it's better for my mental health if I just be myself and admit that I'm into women, you know?
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, similar to me as well. Out of curiosity, I did kiss a guy. Unfortunately, the consequences were I nearly threw up in his beard.
Oh, poor guy. Poor you. Gosh.
I did feel sorry afterwards. I was kind of,
yeah, because like some guys, I'm not saying all of the guys, but some guys are just, they don't mean it, you know? Like they don't mean to make you feel uncomfortable, and they don't mean, just because they're not quite, you know, they might like a lesbian, and when they learn that they're a lesbian, then that totally puts them off, you know? Like I've got some really great, very close male friends who are just not into me simply the fact because I'm a lesbian. And that's like the best scenario in terms of having guy friends. But like, yeah, some, if they're not to know, then, you know, that must make them feel really uncomfortable. The fact that then they made you feel uncomfortable, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's, for some people, it can be quite difficult to understand what's a good thing to sort of ask people and what's not.
Mm.
Like the person I was working with sort of asked me a few questions, and she did sort of say, I'm sorry if I ask anything that makes you uncomfortable. I said, no, I'd rather people ask me so at least I can sort of clarify some things. I'd rather, it's kind of like I've got this, my thought process for if people are curious about things, it's better to ask questions rather than just assume.
Yeah, absolutely. But what I think There's a fine line between just coming out and asking those questions, like say for instance in a supermarket.
And yeah, that's not an appropriate place.
Yeah, exactly. But if they are curious, like we're all very happy to answer those types of questions. It's just like, lead us into it, you know, prepare us for this type of thing. Ask us if it's okay to ask those questions. Because like we might not be in the frame of mind to be able to ask them properly, or you know, it might take us by surprise, and we may see it as an attack, because I know that that's kind of where I've come from sometimes, is I've had people asking me questions because not because they were curious, but because they just wanted to attack me verbally. And just, you know, oh God, you know, God's going to be unhappy that you're into women and blah, 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 and all this. I'm like, oh God, fucking, just please don't, you know?
Yeah, I've seen videos of things like that. I've heard stories from friends and family friends, and it's just like, oh my God, some of the things that they've been, have had shouted at them.
Yeah, yeah. So, fucking lesbian. Yes, actually. And what of it?
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, if someone shouts at you, it's kind of like, well, at least I can hold a relationship unlike you.
Oh, yeah, there is that. I mean, let's face it, female relationships are, they're crazy, they're intense, they're full on, they can be loyal, and once they are loyal, there is no in between, you know. Once you find that one partner, it's just the best, you know. Even though you have to go through an awful lot of dust and dirt to be able to find the diamonds, they are still there.
Oh yeah, I've definitely dated a couple of dusty women.
Dusty. It's gonna be my new word. Oh, how did the date go? Oh, she was a bit dusty.
Oh dear. I mean, I got quite lucky when I met my wife, and it was, there was one really funny thing that happened at a drag show once. Someone actually asked the drag queen asked my wife, like, oh, how long have you and your missus been together? She was like, I think it was like 10 or 11 years at that point.
Oh, you guys are adorable. I love you guys.
And the drag queen was like, oh my God, you're like penguins, you mate for life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, us women, when we get together, we really, really get together. Like that whole U-Haul thing, that's not even a joke. It's not funny. We genuinely do that. We do that because you know we know what we want. As long as the other person isn't a raging psycho like some of my exes. No, I can't even be that mean about it. Like, they didn't know what they wanted because they weren't happy in themselves, and I don't think they'll ever be happy in themselves. And it makes me really sad, but at the same time, I cannot be their savior. I cannot carry them through this world and give them the validation that they so desperately need to give themselves. I wish them all the best, but from a distance, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of like, I want to help you, but at the same time, I've got my own life. I cannot be the messiah for the lesbian crowd.
Oh, God, don't. I just, the amount of women who have either wanted me to be their daddy, and I'm just like, have you taken, have you seen me? Like, you know, just, I have tits, you know? Like, how am I supposed to be your daddy? Like, what's going on? But because I am such an independent and strong person most of my time, yeah, I have my vulnerable moments, but it's very rare that people ever get to see it because I just don't allow everybody to see that side of me, because why should I, you know? But because I'm such a business orientated, driven boss, I would say I'm a boss of many people in terms of being a director. I don't like that word though. Boss is not really, I don't know, maybe just like an organizer. Maybe I just sort of keep everybody organized. I don't know what it's called, but
team leader.
Team leader, I guess. Yeah, that's great. I love it. But because I am this sort of person, like the type of person that I would need to allow into my life and into my private life, there not very many people like that exist. You know, they have to be well aware of themselves, well aware of their own traumas and their own life and what makes them tick. They have to be responsible for themselves, able to take accountability and just genuinely allow themselves to be in a position where they can admit that either they're wrong or they can approach me and tell me that I'm wrong and have the bravery to be able to do that in a loving and coming from a loving position. There are not that many women out there who are in that position. So like some people say that I've got ridiculously high standards, but at the same time, I'm just like, no, I have the bare minimum for somebody who is like me, you know?
I feel exactly the same way.
Right?
Not whenever, because my wife, something happened recently and I've been taking care of her, like, and just doing like little things to like made like an impromptu footstool out of a box.
Aww. Yeah.
Giving her blankets and making drinks for her and like helping her around. And she was like, oh my God, you're so nice to me. I'm just there like, this is the bare minimum. You are in pain.
Yeah. So like, so many people, literally so many people do not understand what the bare minimum actually is. And like, it's not about one person becoming a slave of the other. It's about each other supporting each other in many different ways. And there's a whole spectrum between that. It's like, say, for instance, you both meet and you're both at 100%. But then at the same time, if you've been together for like 6, 12 years, decades, whatever, there might be an instance where you're both at 20% energy. And it's having the knowledge and the self-knowledge to be able to turn around to each other and go, hey, so I'm really not doing okay. How can we right now support ourselves to be able to get back up to that like 50, 80%, but also continue to be kind to each other? And it's having that wherewithal to be able to have that communication between each other. And that in itself is the essence of teamwork and also the bare minimum. It doesn't mean that, you know, you guys might, or we or whatever, like the couple in the example, doesn't mean that they won't be able to like maybe have a couple of days of quiet and not rely on each other and just concentrate on their own needs, as long as they, you know, agree with that and just say, this is what I need right now. This is what I need right now. You know, I love you. I love you. This is how we're going to work through this together. And whether or not that be just taking care of their own needs for a day or two is, you know, is the most important thing.
Exactly. It's a lot of things can break down easily if you just don't communicate in the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, you might get one day one person is at 20% and the other person is at 90. That person who's at 90 can really pull their weight and support the person in there who's at 20%. And then, I don't know, a week later it might switch, you know, or a week later they might both be at 90. And it's, you know, it's one of those things. But this is how I've found my own needs to be. This is where I'm sitting so when I look at somebody and I say, can I date this person? These are the things that I look for when I ask myself that question. And if I don't think that person can meet that need, and that's simple communication. It's not like, you know, oh, I'm having a bad day. I still very much like you. But then that's all the communication you get, and you don't end up with like, hey, so I'm having a really bad day. I still really like you, but I'm running on 20% right now. And my go-to is to be quiet for a couple of days or weeks or months or whatever. You know, like if somebody turns around and says, oh yeah, I still like you, but I'm going through it, and they don't give you any kind of anything in terms of like what's going on and how this is going to play out, then it's a mixed signal. And a mixed signal is a hard no for me.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. When me and my wife first started seeing each other, we both had things going on in our lives, but we talked. I had trouble with communication, especially growing up. When I was a child and teenager, I really struggled. So in my early 20s, I was kind of like, I eventually did start to open up about my things. Like with my wife, it was that like 9 or 10 year mark. That was when I started feeling.
Yeah.
I actually felt happy to turn around and go, I would like to have a cuddle.
Yeah.
Like before then, I was like, I would just kind of like wait for her to. So for me to turn around and say, I would like this from you, it was a big step for me.
Yeah.
But she understood where that came from.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that she did understand where that came from is actually a really beautiful thing, because like, in this world, like, say, for instance, I meet a stranger down the street and I hold the door for them. I would say a huge percentage of people that I meet randomly in the street would not want me to hold the door for them, because they would want to feel empowered by opening the door for themselves. You know, it's kind of the similar in terms of a relationship. When you're in a relationship, especially if you've been hurt in the past, it's going to take you longer to be able to trust the person to ask them for what they want. But at the same time, how is that person supposed to then learn how to love you? And it's that fine line between being okay with waiting for that trust and not, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of picked up on each other's body language. That was like one of the main things. We picked up on each other's mood.
Yeah.
But I mean, when we first started going out, I went to therapy. I started antidepressants. I talked about a lot of things that happened when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And how it kind of, and it took a while for me to feel comfortable enough to mention quite a few things to my wife.
Yeah.
And she was like, okay, that does explain quite a few things now. And she understood that process of how it kind of, in a way, sort of like stumped me for a long time.
Yeah, I understand. I think that therapy is incredibly important in terms of just generally going to understand yourself and who you are and what triggers you and how you deal with things. And it's not like, because you obviously know yourself, but discovering the why and, you know, working out whether or not certain things you can maybe react differently or not, if that makes any sense, is something huge. I think anybody who goes to therapy to understand themselves is one of the, it's one of those things that is a bare minimum for me.
Yeah. To me, going to therapy is kind of like getting an MOT for your car. You don't necessarily have an issue that's noticeable, but sometimes you want to get a checkup just to double check, just make sure.
Yep, exactly that. Oh my God. My engine is clunking. Why is it clunking? As in like, oh, I have this tick during the day. Why am I ticking? What's triggering me? And can I recognize the signs as to where this could potentially go? Like, say for instance, because I've got ADHD, and like me and one of my exes who we are just the best of friends. And she turns around to me the other day and she was like, oh, so how do you control your tics? And I'm like, well, for a start, I try my hardest to figure out where it's coming from. For me, if I was to have a tic or like a twitch or something during the day, it's because I have a frame of mind that is triggering it. And then I backtrack and I try and work out where it's coming from, not to stop myself from ticking, but to preempt anything that could happen in the next couple of days in terms of my mood and my mental health. So usually when my tics are really, really bad, that means that I'm exhausted and I could end up having a micro burnout or a micro meltdown in terms of my hormones, or, you know, because as soon as I end up with a tic, I'm like, oh, where's the moon? Because I know exactly what's going on in my body in terms of the moon, you know. And therapy has helped me discover all this, and it's helped guide me through my world way better. And it's helped me go, okay, when this happens, I need to rest more. And then when this happens, I need to drink more liquid. You know, like it's helped write a blueprint or a manual, so to speak, to a much, much happier life.
Yeah, so therapy, definitely something that is a... I recommend not giving up therapy altogether if you don't find the right therapist on the first attempt.
Yeah. I feel like the first year of therapy, for anybody thinking about it, the first year of therapy is to kind of get used to the idea of therapy and figure out which methods work best, because like what would work for me may not work for somebody else, and it is very it's a huge spectrum. Then like just be honest with yourself. If you feel like rageful, then write it down. Figure out why you're feeling rageful. Write down the first things that come to your mind. You know, it could be anything. Oh, I stubbed my toe this morning, and that like set me up for a really bad day, because then ever since then I was like stressed in my head for stubbing my toe and taking it too hardly on myself, because like I'm rushing around and making big mistakes, and you know that could be a sign that you may make a bigger mistake during the day, you know, like not thinking straight and having a foggy head and not taking care of your health and not taking care of your diet. And sorry, I'm going down a hole again, aren't I?
No, you're fine. I mean, yeah, all of that, it's a very slippery slope, especially if you don't... I mean, I didn't know that I was suffering from depression when I was really, really struggling.
Yeah.
I thought I was just... Like, there were times where I woke up in the morning and actually felt upset that I didn't die in my sleep. Like, it was that bad.
Wow, that's a horrible place to be. Like, it's just, and yeah, I've known many moments where I've been like, oh man, like, I don't know if I could keep fighting and working as hard as I can. Like, what would happen if I weren't around in terms, I'm not saying like, for me, I've never been in that position per se, but at the same time, those thoughts in my head have been like, what would happen? Would everybody be okay? Because like, I feel like the pressure that I'm under to keep everybody safe and, you know, going, and like, I find that I put too much pressure on myself to look after everybody else. And I do sometimes wonder if like they would be okay without me helping them. But then I just go back and I help them anyway, because literally that's who I am, you know? But there are moments when you're in that like shadow thinking things like that, and it's a horrible, horrible place to be. both of us are just like, whew, that was deep.
Yeah. Well, it's nice that someone understands where I'm coming from with a lot of these. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I I've been around for nearly 40 years. I've been through an awful lot, and like my empathy for other people is gigantic. Sometimes I share too much of my own experiences in order to try and show people that I care, because I've been through something similar. And that's another conversation for another podcast, but there's so much in terms of the way that I just want to turn around and help people when I hear their stories, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I get that too, where I take on other people's problems and I want to like troubleshoot how to help them.
Yeah.
And it just emotionally, mentally drains being my wife. Yeah. Has actually said to me a few times, like, you need to step back and just kind of like not get too, don't get as emotionally invested in this.
You know, I get told that a lot. There's a lot going on right now that I get so emotionally invested in. And I've just turned around to myself the past couple of weeks and went, what would happen if I just stopped caring about the outcome of this particular thing? Like, I don't know, in a video game, for instance, like I would grind really hard because I wanted this car and things like that. And like I would just spend all of my time grinding. And I just went, well, what do I really need this car in this video game for? Like, am I enjoying this video game because I'm grinding so hard, or am I just like missing out on the rest of the game? Am I like, should I take my character up and just watch the sunset and just fucking just enjoy the art of it, you know? And it's really changed my perspective on the rest of my life. I've, you know, if I don't get this particular one thing in my film, like, will I be able to make an amazing film regardless, you know? And that's been another thing that has really changed the way that I work. And it's been really helping me with my anxiety and my energy levels to just let the universe do its thing. And if it comes through, then it comes through. But I just need to stop trying to control the outcome of it.
Oh, yeah, where can our lovely listeners find you?
The lovely listeners can find me at disturbia-films.com. I also have a bunch of social medias. You can link yourselves through that website as well. So everything is all in one place. I'm also on TikTok as well. If you can take the time to find me, it's Disturbia Films on TikTok.
I hope everyone enjoyed that episode as much as me and my guest. You can like, share, subscribe. You can also leave us a comment, join our Patreon. You can always send us suggestions for episodes or franchises. If you're interested, our Patreon is £3 a month. You get extra episodes, seasonal ones and franchise ones as well. So I hope everyone enjoyed themselves, and we'll see you in the next one.